Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on January 30th, 2018. This is the week 4 class of our 2018 12-week Dhamma study based on my book, The Truth of Happiness. This class is on the wisdom factors of the Eightfold Path. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So tonight's class is the beginning of three classes on the Eightfold Path, and the three classes are delineated, separated by the way the Eightfold Path is often characterized as a path of wisdom, virtue, and concentration. So tonight's class is on the wisdom aspects, right view and right intention. The Eightfold Path is the fourth noble truth, and the Buddha presented the Eightfold Path to recognize and overcome the problem of ignorance and resulting conditioned thinking. A mind that is rooted in ignorance will continue to develop very subtle but very powerful strategies that allow it to ignore its own ignorance. It's that that nearly impenetrable veil of ignorance that makes awakening so difficult, and it makes or it requires someone with clear vision and right view in order to present that. When the Buddha awakened, he considered for another 2 weeks how to teach what he knew, and if it was possible to penetrate that veil of ignorance, how could he do it? A deluded mind, you think about this for a minute, how would a deluded mind know that it's deluded if it's deluded? It would need a framework to recognize its own delusion. It would need something to shine a light on its own delusion. And that's when the Buddha decided on presenting his teaching in the form of four noble truths and this fourth truth of an Eightfold Path. And the Eightfold Path begins and ends in right view. I'm going to just read a couple of quotes from the Buddha from the article, and I'll comment briefly on that. I won't talk too long tonight. Yay! The Buddha's words, and what is right view? And notice how this relates directly to each of the Four Noble Truths. And what is right view? Knowledge with regard to stress, the first noble truth. Knowledge with regard to the origination of stress, the second noble truth. Knowledge with regard to the cessation of stress, the third noble truth. And knowledge with regard to the path or practice that develops the cessation of stress. This is called right view. Notice how right view, as the Buddha is presenting it here, is an all-encompassing view that is able to hold in mind, be mindful of, four noble truths in a way that frames our relationship with ourselves and the world around us. We have integrated the four noble truths. The Buddha describes right view as the forerunner of the path. In other words, the aspect of the path that we first encounter or engage with. And how is right view the forerunner? One discerns wrong view as wrong view. Initially, we simply recognize that the way we're looking at ourselves in relation to the world is not producing the happy results we hope. We recognize that something's missing, and that we don't have to classify that as a wrong view, but there's something that brought each and every one of us here tonight and brought each and every one of us to look at spiritual teachings in general, and then eventually to come, like we have, to look at the words of the Buddha and what he taught. That's the beginning of right view, simply accepting that I don't know everything. A mind that is full of the ignorance that it knows everything can never develop awakening. At some point, there has to be an opening there, a realization that, well, maybe I just don't know everything. That's the beginning of right view, and it really is that simple. And then, in order to continue to develop awakening, it requires all the other aspects of the path, and I'll get into that here tonight. It's really brilliant when you realize how the Buddha developed this and presented it in a way that's useful for anybody whose mind is rooted in ignorance. One discerns wrong view as wrong view, and right view as right view. Immediately we begin to realize what is the skillful or appropriate way to look at the world and ourselves in relation to that world. And right view is right view. This is one's right view. Remember, the Buddha is referring now to the beginning of the path, the forerunner. We begin to develop right view as soon as we start to integrate the factors of the Eightfold Path. And what is wrong view? There is nothing given, nothing offered, nothing sacrificed. What is Buddha referring to there? The Buddha means there's nothing sacrificed from the point of view of a self-referential ego self. In other words, that nothing sacrificed means I'm not willing to give up even a shred of my own ignorance or my own views. And that is the essential nature of anatta. Anatta means the not self-characteristic. The Buddha used that word to describe that experience as the views that we're holding do not constitute a self. They're not based in reality. Let go of the views. So the beginning of awakening is recognizing that some of the views that I'm holding, most likely all of the views eventually, are wrong views and are contributing to my own confusion, deluded thinking, and stress. I have to be willing. Remember the forerunner. I have to be willing, as I engage with this Eightfold Path, to recognize and abandon views that are rooted in ignorance. And how do I do that? With the entire framework of the Eightfold Path. I have to be willing to sacrifice. Probably every one of you has had the experience that this feels like annihilation, especially in the beginning. Aren't I letting go of everything that's essential for me? And many, we have that conversation. It's an ongoing conversation here. This feels like it feels like I'm dying. Well, that's the experience of sacrifice. But in the end, what we're letting go of is, as the Buddha describes it, is like foam on the ocean. There's nothing there. But when we are clinging strongly to these views that we've used to establish ourselves, it does feel like annihilation. And it feels like I don't want to give anything up. I don't want to sacrifice anything. The very beginning of the teachings, the Buddha is saying you have to be willing to do that, but in a very gentle way. There's nothing harsh about developing the Eightfold Path, although at times it feels like that, but that's coming from our own judgment of ourself. There is nothing given, nothing offered, nothing sacrificed. There is no fruit or result of good or bad actions. What does it mean? No fruit. It means we're not recognizing the benefits of doing this because our minds are still rooted in ignorance. But very quickly when we start to integrate the Eightfold Path, I think everyone that has actually done that has talked about almost immediately you realize that at least your mind is starting to calm and you're developing a measure of concentration. And it's usually recognized in your relationship to other people. You find that you're just not in conflict as much. The reason why that is you're not in conflict with your own mind anymore, or at least in it to a diminished capacity. There is no this world, no next world, no mother, no father. No spontaneously reborn beings. It sounds almost mystical, doesn't it? But the Buddha is teaching a very practical Dhamma. What he's referring to, and he's really referring directly to karma, as we develop the Eightfold Path and begin to integrate it, we're not contributing to our own confusion, delusion, and we're no longer giving birth to a moment that inclines us to becoming further ignorant. In this moment, as we develop the Eightfold Path, we're giving birth to the next moment that is inclined towards awakening. No mother, no father refers to what are we engaged with that's going to give birth to what we're experiencing. If it's framed by the Eightfold Path, we'll give birth towards a mind that is inclined towards awakening. Is that clear? Any questions on that? There's really so much in these first few paragraphs that, as the Buddha is describing right view, he's really describing the whole process of awakening. And he's telling us in a very practical way what to do and what not to do. We have to be mindful of what we're giving birth to in this moment. No Brahmins or contemplatives who, faring rightly and practicing rightly, proclaim this world and the next world. And this, I'm not talking about a future birth, and the Buddha's not. The world in this context, this world and the next world is simply what's occurring now and what we're giving birth to. Because if you truly understand karma and rebirth, you see everything as a continuum of either wrong thinking or right thinking. And a continuum rooted in wrong thinking can only continue ignorance. The continuum rooted in right view or right thinking continues awakening. And so when the Buddha is referring to Brahmins and contemplatives, now he's talking about people that are actually developing the path. And that could be pretty confusing, because Brahmins, the word Brahmin has, going back to the Buddha's time, has many different references. But remember, in this instance, the Buddha is referring to developing right view. I'm going to go back to that. No, Brahmins are contemplatives who, faring rightly and practicing rightly, proclaim this world and the next after having directly known and realized it for themselves. Another important understanding. This is to be directly realized ourselves. It's not something that you can just listen to. It's not something that you can just have faith in and maybe develop it conceptually. You have to actually develop an Eightfold Path. If that wasn't the case, the Buddha wouldn't have taught an Eightfold Path. He would have said, this is reality, you know, good luck. Figure it out on yourself, on your own. But he realized the nature of ignorance, so he presented an Eightfold Path. The Buddha continues, there is no fruit or result of good or bad actions, means that that there is no understanding of the consequences of our own ignorance. But again, the framework of the Eightfold Path shows that to us immediately. I'm going to skip ahead just a little bit. Here the Buddha is teaching and showing how the Eightfold Path in right view is supported by the other factors such as right effort and right mindfulness that we'll talk about in 2 weeks. One tries to abandon wrong view and enter and remain in right view. This is how the Buddha describes right mindfulness, to be mindful when in wrong view and enter and remain in right view. Initially, that right view is, I'm not quite sure what's occurring, or I have no understanding of what's occurring. Let me develop the Eightfold Path so I can see things clearly. This is one's right effort. By engaging in the development of right view, that is one's own effort. And how do we, one's right effort, and how do we do it? We incorporate the entire Eightfold Path. One is mindful to abandon wrong view and to enter and remain in right view. This is one's right mindfulness. Thus, these three qualities, right view, right effort, and right mindfulness, run and circle around right view. They're all part of an integrated Eightfold Path. Is that clear? And do you see the mutually supportive nature of each factor of the Eightfold Path now? We'll get into that a little bit deeper next week on the virtuous factors. But it's a complete but necessary Eightfold Path. In other words, if we left out one aspect of it, especially right view, but any aspect of the Eightfold Path that is dismissed or not developed is going to result in continued ignorance. Clear? Mm-hmm. And what is right view? Knowledge with regard to... Wait a minute. What's that? Back to the beginning. These are the consequences of maintaining wrong views, the Buddha's words. In a person of wrong view, wrong resolve or wrong intention comes into being. And that's the, you could say that's the initiation. If you remember the dependent origination from ignorance of Four Noble Truths comes fabrications and the whole unfolding of suffering as a result. In a person of wrong view, wrong intention or wrong resolve comes into being. In a person of wrong resolve, wrong speech directly leads to the first of the virtuous factors. If we are holding wrong intention or wrong resolve, we easily fall into wrong speech, don't we? Why? Because we're using our speech and our actions and our livelihood to continue to establish and promote a self that is rooted in ignorance. And it can only be prone to confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing suffering. In a person of wrong speech, wrong action. In a person of wrong action, wrong livelihood. See how that it ties directly and leads directly to the virtuous factors of the Eightfold Path. Do you have a question more?
Well, I get. I was trying to pull up the article because I read it and then I was a little confused and something So then I realized, hey, you know, you can read along with it when you're reading, which sometimes can be helpful. When I read the article, you know how sometimes there's that the point where you're like, oh, I've heard this 1,000 times, you know. So, and then tonight, the way you're describing it sounds somewhat different, because again, we've always said that it's ignorance of the Four Noble Truths that is the issue at hand in right view.
Yes.
Right? So, okay, so you accept it on the mundane level. I accept that I'm ignorant of what causes true happiness, in a sense, right? Because I'm identified and clinging to a self that has to assert itself in everything. And that self and that confusion is going to keep grasping and grasping and grasping at the outside. So we're confused. But I think, so where my question is kind of like, right, I understand, I mean, again, we've been up and down this tree for many years now. So take it from that perspective. So there is still an awful lot of confused karma. Like, I'm not mindful in every present moment, and there is still clinging and craving that continues. So mundane right view says, "Oh, okay, there you're caught. You know, you're grasping, you're clinging and craving," but. So we always talk about how you can give birth to a more awakened moment or a more deluded and ignorant moment. And I would just say, you know, if I look back at the day, you know, yeah, it feels like 70% of them are probably, maybe, okay, like 50 are deluded moments that are coming.
Are you talking in general or yourself?
I'm talking about me. I mean, I'm talking about my experience, you know, so... And the way that you're explaining it tonight, again, it sounds like when you hear this, you should just get it. No more ignorant moments. Come on now, you know.
That's right. What's the problem?
So, I just, that hasn't been my experience. But I do understand it, and it becomes more and more clear as concentration develops, and there's something, you know, in the momentum of concentration and in the repetitive nature of recognizing right view and right intention, you know, like overbanding, coming, and clearing. But still, even with that, you know, there's a lot of ignorance. There's a lot of ignorant self-grasping that continues. But it's almost like then there's this part that's not deluded anymore that can see that for what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and kind of like, phew. But, so... the way that you're reading it tonight, it sounds like, again, like just stop giving birth to those ignorant moments.
Yes.
And I can understand that that's what the first said. And I don't know how those 5 guys awoken at that first time. I don't believe it. And then, like, and then he said, at the next discourse, 100 of them.
Yeah. It's amazing.
So you're jealous of their awakening?
Probably. But that's the side of me that's the 50% that's still ignorant and clinging. The other part of me is it has appreciative joy for their
Okay, 50 cents, we got a question there?
So I guess the question is kind of, did I hear you correctly in that you should just stop giving birth to these ignorant moments?
Yep.
Or...
More, we've known each other for 10 years, and I don't know if you've ever heard me correctly, except this once. Yes. Just let him go. That's the simple way. Let them go. But the problem is we have this thing called a self-referential ego self that doesn't want to let go. And hence, the Eightfold Path. Kandana heard this once and he awakened. The other four fellows heard it the next sutta and they awakened. The third sutta, the Aditya Pariyaya Sutta, the sutta on the fire discourse, 1,000 folks heard this and they awakened. Yet there's Purananda, the Buddha's cousin, who heard every teaching the Buddha ever gave, and he didn't awaken until a month after the Buddha passed. And the importance of the Dhamma is awakening. The time it takes is completely unimportant. Doesn't matter. It's a self-referential ego self that insists that I must awaken right now, or it's got to be quick, or it compares itself to other people, or struggles with the fact that it has more to do, that it's not just eating a piece of chocolate cake and you're good to go, or listening to it, or reading a book, or reading a sutta.
Well, I don't mind taking a long time, but when you hear it, it sounds like... So the ego mind maybe hears it as like you should mind that it's taken a long time.
Well, there is
I really am.
Yeah, you are, and I think you would say you've made great strides in developing your own understanding, and there's still more to do.
And concentration has, needless to say, gotten much much better, and that. That's a momentum, a snowball that just keeps pushing forward.
And it's a required snowball. We couldn't do this without without deepening our own concentration. Again, the whole purpose of meditation that we'll get to. The things that you describe, it's important to recognize the benefits of practice, and it's just as important to recognize that my view is still slightly cloudy. Maybe very cloudy. When referring to what the Buddha taught, he taught an incredibly simple and direct Dhamma. It doesn't mean that the experience of it is simple and direct. And it's only because our minds are so confused. It's not because the Dhamma is so confused. So we could almost be discouraged from the point of view of a self-referential ego self, by listening to the Buddha's words in their simplicity and thinking, well, why can't I get it? Why is this such a struggle? Why do I have to put in so much effort, the sixth factor of the Eightfold Path? We have to do it because an awakened human being says it's likely to take a little bit of effort. We might have to something that keeps us going. We might have to, the second thing that I'll talk about tonight, briefly now, is the second factor of the Eightfold Path, right intention. Right intention is the intention to recognize and abandon the cause of my own suffering, craving and clinging. And that's what keeps us well focused too. We need that. We need that right intention to get us past something when we're struggling with it.
Well, and I don't mind, like that sounds much more like...
Well, then let me finish my talk.
I don't mind hard work. I mean, I don't mind... Patience is something, but somehow the reading tonight sounded like there isn't a lot of hard work or patience or practice.
Let me finish what.
And then I'll stop. I'm not going to pass me when you go on for comments. I've given up.
Well, the Buddha's not... Remember, he gave... The number is 84,000 suttas. The number just means a lot. Nobody knows how many. Well, it was a lot in the Sutta Pitakas. He did that because there's... And every one of those suttas was situational and in context of dependent origination and Four Noble Truths. If you took one of those... just read a sutta from the Buddha, you probably wouldn't even know how to apply it. But when you understand why and how the Buddha gave all these different discourses with different subjects, but always in that right context, it's because he was directing it at different conceptual applications, all rooted in ignorance, that have attached themselves to things that seem real. So the ongoing process of awakening can be long and arduous. But the Buddha is describing the process in as simple a way of as possible to pierce through our own ignorance, But that it doesn't imply that it's going to be instantaneous for any of us, or even even quickly developed.
It's simple, it's not easy.
Yeah. Yeah, I used to say, I should probably say it more, it's a path of ease and joy, but it's not for the faint of heart. We have to have, what the Buddha just said here, we have to have that right resolve, because we can't do it without it. It's not a quick fix, and that, you know, that's the other problem with a distracted mind. A distracted mind needs something right now to continue its distraction. It needs something to be quick. Okay, I'm deluded, I accept it, but I can't wait to awaken. I don't have the patience for that. Why? Because I'm having too much fun with myself. We have to recognize that this is, to me, and I, you know, when I finally understood what the Buddha was actually teaching and how effective it was, that was my big aha moment in my life. Then I've had a lot others in developing the Dhamma. Because I realized that here, I understood, it was the beginning of right view. Here's a path that an awakened human being taught, and that path is still available to me. And most remarkably to me is that I have a mind, not that I have anything, a special type of mind, it doesn't take one. I have a human mind that's able to grasp this. This awakening human being understood my mind and everybody else's 2,600 years ago, and how to develop, how to pierce my own ignorance. And that path still works 2,600 years later. It was a path that was able to pierce even my ignorance. And if it can pierce my ignorance, it can pierce yours. that's really what the Buddha is saying. So it is simplistic, and it's seemingly simplistic, but the application is so deep and profound that ultimately it affects every thought that we ever have. And it takes those thoughts with right view. It takes a thought that is rooted in wrong view and allows for the dismissal of that thought and clinging to that thought and clinging to that view, and to recognize awakening. So let me continue this. Let me go back to that too. And a person of wrong view, wrong resolve, or wrong intention comes into being. And a person of wrong resolve, wrong speech, and a person of wrong speech, wrong action. And a person of wrong action, wrong livelihood. And a person of wrong livelihood, wrong effort. Now you see how, again, pointing to what you said more, see how the Buddha's showing if we continue in our conditioned way of living, we can only continue to engage in wrong effort. And what's the result of wrong effort? Continued confusion, delusion, and suffering. And a person of wrong effort, wrong mindfulness. If our efforts are focused in anything outside of the Dhamma, including any embellishments to the Dhamma, will only continue wrong mindfulness. Wrong mindfulness means to recollect or to hold in mind. It means that we're holding in mind wrong views. It's a continuation of the primary problem of ignorance. In a person of wrong mindfulness, wrong concentration, or just continued distraction, in a person of wrong concentration, wrong knowledge, if we're holding in mind,
concentration be just it's you're concentrating on something that is not going to bring you to awakening.
And exactly.
So it's not a distraction. It's maybe distraction from the Dhamma.
Well, it is
concentration, focused attention, but on something that's going to cause suffering.
Yes, but again, you could use a qualifier in just about every word, meaning the Buddha could stop at concentration. This is what I mean by blah 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 blah, and you never get to the point. Mm-hmm. The point is that a mind that is rooted in wrong views is distracted by an infinite number of things that it can't hold attention on, even though in the moment it's concentrated. I always use, you know, chocolate cake. I can't stop thinking about the next piece of chocolate cake. That's a form of concentration, but it's a distraction. It just means that what I'm holding in mind is leading me to further delusion. And we can do that with anything. And so, we create incredibly subtle but powerful strategies to continue to ignore our own ignorance, what we hold in mind. And we'll hold in mind anything to do that. We'll get distracted by anything, including so-called spiritual practices. This is something that Buddha addressed during his time, and it's certainly prevalent today. We think things are... Or we come across something that makes us feel good, and we might want to make it part of our Dhamma practice rather than seeing it separately for what it is. in a person of wrong concentration, wrong knowledge. In a person of wrong knowledge, wrong release. So the Buddha's using...
What does that mean, release?
Well, again, the Buddha's using a term that relates to his Dhamma, meaning gaining awakening, but we're gaining the wrong kind of awakening. We'll come across things, and the Buddha recognizes even during... Even some of the people that listened to the Buddha and left and looked for other teachings, and they gained a certain measure of satisfaction in the teachings, but the teachings themselves were continuing that distraction. Because in the moment they felt good or they answered some questions, remember Vajragoda. Vajragoda kept coming to the Buddha asking these great questions, leaving in a huff because the Buddha didn't answer the great questions. And he'd go around and he'd find someone that would answer his questions. He felt better. He felt a release. Someone told him then, you know, that where am I, who do I come from, who is God? Somebody came along and told Vajragoda, well, this is what it is. And Vajragoda bought into it, so he felt better. He was just led astray, though. There was no real view because the initial intention that Vajragoda had was to continue to find a so-called spiritual practice that would justify him continuing wrong views. In other words, attaching himself to these answers that allowed him to continue eye-making. Is that clear?
I've sometimes heard of wrong as incomplete, like complete or incomplete. And it kind of almost...
Well, you got to be careful with that, because if you start from the deluded premise that, and I have no understanding of the Dhamma, that it's only, my views are only incomplete, then all I need, I don't have to recognize the wrong views.
Mm-hmm.
I can build on my incomplete views. And that leads directly to, and that is the motivation that led to the Mahasanghika seeking a different Dhamma than what the Buddha taught, which was a precursor to modern Mahayana Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
How can we, I really like the idea of being a Buddhist, but how can I do it in a way that allows me to continue eye-making? Just that way. I'm incomplete. I need to add something to these wrong views. That's the embellishment.
Is incomplete release, because it could be like a faux release. So I don't even
exactly.
Want
to, it is.
You should have, and
Scott too. That's such an important point, because it leads to the problem of false dharmas or just false beliefs that again, this is why I refer to the subtle and powerful way of continuing ignorance, because the self-referential ego self will attach itself to anything that will allow it to continue, including spiritual beliefs that only lead one astray. So the Buddha continues that. Let me go back one line again. In a person of wrong concentration, wrong knowledge, in a person of wrong knowledge, wrong release, the Buddha concludes this. And with saying, this is how from wrongness comes failure, not success. Going directly back to the beginning of this, what we focus on, what we hold in mind, is going to determine our moment-by-moment life. As far as awakening is concerned, what we focus on and what we're mindful of is going to determine, whether we actually awaken, or our Dhamma practice is simply a continuation of our own ignorance. And what Mora was talking about, it's so simple and direct, that is out of necessity, because our minds are so confused and deluded. We need something simple and direct, something that really hits us right between the eyes in order to recognize it and make use of it. And again, this is, right view is the beginning, the entry point into developing the Eightfold Path. And it's also, profound right view is a right view, as the Buddha describes it, an awakened human being, awakened right view, is a view that completely, at a very profound and penetrative level, understands the nature of suffering. And the Buddha describes that awakened human being's mind, that fully mature human being's mind, as calm and at peace. We've let go of everything that is confused and deluded about ourselves in relation to the world, and we've developed awakening. We develop a calm and peaceful mind. That's the talk for tonight. Any questions about the talk? No? Okay. I'd like to hear how your Dhamma practice has been going. in relation to this, the wisdom factors of the Eightfold Path, and how your, if you understand the initial entryway into the path of right view, simply accepting that the views you're holding of yourself in relation to the world are wrong views. So we'll start with Ron. Good to see you.
Thank you. I was thinking a little bit earlier about, okay, am I in, how's my right view? And, you know, am I really looking at all three noble truths pretty consistently? And I can't say that I do, but then I look further down the sutta and I think, but my right speech is pretty okay. My right action is coming along. So somewhere along the line, I am looking at life through right view. And it's more in the day-to-day life that I see the consequences of that, more than that I have those factors always right in my hand, you know, and I can apply them every minute. Just things are going along actually quite nicely. The intention is actually more focused. I really want to do this. This is what I'm setting out to do. And it's almost become automatic.
Thank you. I mean, you're describing the practical application of the path and its benefits, and it's so important to recognize that. Maybe you're not quite there yet, but you can see how the integration of the Eightfold Path has enhanced the quality of your life. I mean, that's the point of it. Mm-hmm. It's not this, you know, that we sometimes look at spiritual practice, even though we don't recognize it, as an escape from our own suffering rather than a way of developing understanding. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the difficulty of integrating the Eightfold Path. It's not, you know, it doesn't at least initially make us feel so good.
No,
you know, it's not an instant fix.
You have to face it. You have to really face stuff like you have to face a wrong view.
Yeah.
Pretty consistently for a long time before you finally start to let go of the wrong view.
Yeah. And we
start to see that it's not working.
And we recognize wrong view and its manifestations through the virtuous factor, we'll get into this next week, through the virtuous factors of the Eightfold Path. How do I know that I'm stuck in a wrong view? Well, if I'm constantly gossiping or lying or engaging in idle chatter, it's, I mean, there's such practical teachings. But a person rooted in eye-making, stuck in wrong views, engages in those types of activity almost enthusiastically and jealously, and we want to hold on to it. So as we develop the Eightfold Path and integrate it, we recognize where we need to continue to develop. And that's how the Buddha described it, to be mindful when in wrong view and enter in right view, to be mindful when in wrong speech. That's why they're there. They're simple teachings to frame our own behavior. And if our behavior is on the unskillful aspects of it, we simply recognize it so that we can abandon it. We don't have to pick it apart or analyze it or anything. You know, it's just not helpful. So, and you describe that too. You just recognize it and let it go. You don't have to figure out and analyze where our conditioned response to life came from. That really is unimportant in the context of the Eightfold Path. It's simply enough to recognize and let it go. Thank you. Scott, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you. We wouldn't know wrong view unless we had right view, right? We wouldn't know right view unless we knew wrong view.
Yes. And again, there's the framework of the Eightfold Path.
Is that yin-yang? Is that what that means?
I never looked at it that way.
Okay.
Since you brought it up, yin and yang are typically portrayed as two necessary sides of life, a real broad explanation of what they mean. We wouldn't need to develop or have a focus on right view if there wasn't wrong view in existence. Mm-hmm. as we develop right view, a fully mature human being, an awakened human being, no longer has any aspects of wrong view. So that yin and yang concept, it really doesn't come into play there.
And how do we all come here to this path? I mean, basically, it seems kind of odd. Would the same things bring us here?
Everyone's read Buddhist books, right?
In general, the same... You could say that the same thing brought us here in relation to the First Noble Truth as an unsatisfying or disappointing experience in life.
Mm-hmm.
We think something's missing.
Mm-hmm.
And so we start looking for what that is. And then the important point, the Buddha recognized that too, but he also understood that in order to focus our path, it needed to be simple, but it also needed to address the problem of ignorance. How do we pierce that veil of ignorance?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I don't think anybody decides to change the way they're thinking unless their thinking is not serving them well, at least in some aspects. You know, through a disappointing life experience. At some level, it doesn't mean that I would bet that there's no one here that had. Yeah, it doesn't really matter. I was going to say that I don't think there's anyone here that had some type of extreme physical suffering or even emotional suffering caused by the environment. But maybe we have. I don't know. I don't know everybody's story here. But it doesn't take that. It takes a desire to understand what's the cause of my own unsatisfactory nature and unsatisfactory experience in life. What's missing?
Is it also a matter, I hear myself saying that there's a required amount of intelligence to actually see that, hey folks, this is not working for me. How can I not suffer like this? A lot of people
I don't
seem to kind of be going through their lives and living those lives of quiet desperation and just go on.
I think it might be the other way, Ram. I think that too much intelligence can really, because you think you know it all, and if you are a person of high intelligence, you've probably achieved a lot, and that could really be a hindrance. Yeah, and again, I think to answer your question, though, I think I don't know that intelligence really has any bearing. Ultimately, our own conditioned mind is the problem, and so we can be conditioned from all types of things. The problem of ignorance and the resulting suffering affects everyone more or less equally.
Mm.
So the important thing, and Scott, it really was such an important question. The nature of suffering is pervasive. It's the First Noble Truth. And this is an awakened human being's teaching. These apply to every human being. But not every human being is going to accept responsibility for their own suffering. A self-referential ego self does not want to accept responsibility for anything. And so it will seek out anything else in order to do that. That's another way of saying it ignores its own ignorance. The Buddha said, if you want to... Remember, the Buddha didn't see himself as a savior. He didn't see what he was teaching as salvific. He didn't go out trying to drum up followers. He simply taught what he taught. And if you wanted to follow him, fine. And if you didn't, fine. But if you decided to develop the Dhamma, and then go out and teach others, he insisted that you teach what he taught. And we've heard me tell stories about how he heard of people that went out saying that they were teaching what the Buddha taught, and he heard that they were teaching something else, and he called them back in and said, basically, please don't do that. Sometimes he used even stronger words. Simply to maintain the purity and the authenticity of his Dhamma. Scott, thank you for that.
We're all tired of wrong view. We're just tired of it.
I would say that's true.
And then you get to be tired of it for a long time while you're here.
Well, that's part of the disappointing nature of holding on to views, isn't it? We get tired of it. It's a difficult way to live our lives, even though most of us will continue unless we find something we have to find something that shows us our own ignorance so that we can change it. And again, it's not a general pervasive ignorance. It's ignorance, a very specific ignorance of Four Noble Truths. This is the right view and right intention is the beginning of recognizing that and abandoning it. Christine, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Good. Doing good. Doing the reading, comprehending everything, and kind of catching myself, thinking in terms of, like, is this a right view, is this a wrong view? And so I'm glad of that. And then just kind of trying to practice not making this any kind of race. And just enjoying my meditation practice.
Yeah, thank you. That's the way to do it. Be very gentle with yourself, and it takes a little time. But when we understand that this is the meaning of true refuge, that an awakened human being did this and he awakened, he left us the path, the Dhamma, and we have a supportive Sangha. I mean, we have all three of the most important aspects of awakening right here. Thank you. Margaret, good to see you tonight. How are you?
So something you just said, sort of getting to what I'm trying to figure out, which is, I understand, I'm getting the sort of looping back, that the whole Eightfold Path, right? These are integrated steps that we sort of do circle back, right? So you said that it's not as important to understand the origins of wrong view, just that you have them, right? Did I hear that correctly?
Maybe. I might have said that, but I think I want to adjust it.
Another class will come. I'm just thinking that in the context of right action, which I know we haven't gotten to yet. But I've been thinking a lot about the sort of biases that we bring to how we interact with the world that are very much dependent on sort of our cultural conditioning.
Yes, I would say that the beginning is not so much understanding the origins, just to accept the fact that I'm stuck in wrong views or I'm engaged in wrong views. And then that leads to an understanding of the origination of our wrong views. That's the profound understanding of understanding the nature of suffering. And we understand that it's rooted in craving for and clinging to a self-referential existence. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we're going with it. So, boy, what a profound question. And I interrupt you, I'm sorry.
No, that was it. But in terms of my practice, it's going well. But I feel, and this could be a self-referential ego-making statement, but I feel like I can get just sort of bogged down in the reading and just get too intellectual about it.
Yep.
So it's better for me to just practice it in the world.
Yeah.
So I may not be able to speak exactly to what this is, but I can feel it when it's happening.
Yeah. And that's of primary importance, to have the experience of it. The intellectual, when we learn anything, we first encounter something intellectual. We read it, or somebody says something to it. But it doesn't, as far as the Dhamma is concerned, it doesn't have any real meaning until we actually develop it. The Buddha kept using that word, ehipasiko, come and see for yourself, meaning we have to come and see for ourselves. We have to have the experience of recognizing and abandoning wrong views. And how do we do it? It really is remarkable how we describe that, almost every class and almost to a person. We recognize the practical way of integrating this into our lives. And that's just how it is.
Mm-hmm.
So good for you. Thank you. Mary Beth, good to see you. How are you? I'm glad you're here. More?
I'm good. Pass.
Glad you're here tonight. Helen, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Thank you. Good to be here. I don't think I have anything really profound to say. I agree with Margaret in that it starts here, but it's clearer as you live it out and then you learn to articulate about it. So I understand what you're saying there.
Yeah.
So this is a total aside and sort of a course correction. I was on a plane earlier today and I guess everybody's snacks were kicking in and people were in the aisle waiting to go to the restrooms. And there were two people that were trying to pass each other, and it became one of those Laurel and Hardy moments where they truly got stuck. And so that's what I did inside my head. I laughed, and then I was like, is that right view or right speech or right laugh or right... I started thinking about funniest home videos, and what do we laugh at when people fall down and crash and burn and stuff. So anyway, so I was kind of thinking about those two people stuck in the aisle, and that was just funny.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it's okay. I mean, it's okay to laugh at the absurdity of life. It just is, because life is often absurd that way.
Nobody was hurt.
Right, exactly.
So
did they seem troubled by it? Like, did it seem embarrassed?
No, and it was only just, you know,
Right. They managed.
I don't think I laughed out loud. So anyway, but it just made me think about, you know, there are funny things that happen in life, and you know, maybe somebody could feel awkward or uncomfortable about it. So, like, I wasn't sure where that fell.
It all had to do with your intention, Helen.
Okay, well, I had no intention of hurting anybody.
There you go.
Maybe
clinging to a self. Because that's really, you know, so much of what intention is letting go of clinging and craving. Mm.
Well, I wasn't craving for them to be stuck any longer.
That's funny. No worries.
Thank you, Helen. Mary, how are you tonight? Good to see you.
Good. Thank you, Mary. This one is really good. This is, I guess, for everyone. It's a big one. Getting right view. Making progress in that area. One of the things in my reading that stuck out was right thinking, you know, because the whole thinking piece is trouble right there, you know, if I think, or if you're thinking too much, or if you're caught in a loop in your head, and those things are all contribute to wrong view. So I don't know if I have anything else to say except that I really value this one. I think I've always struggled with the whole idea of, you know, I'm sure I've said 1,000 times in my life, how do you just let it go? Like, how does that work? How does that happen? And not really understanding that. And even the first time I heard the sutra about the severing, you know, and that was like, what does that mean? How do you use that in real life? But anyway, I feel like I made some progress on it. This week and in this reading and in this talk. It's very helpful. I feel like I, like many of us, that I was reading it for the very first time, like I had never heard of it before. And it was with the wisdom of having invested so much time to turn around and come back to this place again.
Yeah.
It was really a beautiful read, so thank you.
Thank you. Isn't it remarkable that we can read the same thing over and over again, and yet it seems so entirely, well, I'm not going to say different, but entirely
meaningful.
More meaningful.
Yeah.
You know? And that's just the Dhamma, because it really gets to the depths of our own thinking, our own psyche. And there's all types of, I don't even want to use the word levels, but there's all types of levels of our own ignorance that it pierces, and it gets to the heart of the matter. And it's the other thing that's remarkable about the Buddha's teaching is its utter practicality. In other words, the Buddha is not saying, in order to develop right view, you must engage in all types of rites and rituals that have nothing to do with that. You must bow a lot or chant a lot. You must appease deities or anything like that. I'm not putting that type of practice down. But there's nothing of that here. Everything the Buddha teaches is practically applied to our own thinking and our own conditioned thinking. And it's in its directness and its simplicity that it works. There's nothing here to distract us, is there?
It's just psychology, basically, isn't it?
But very basic, you know. It's and maybe the most authentic type of psychology, because it gets right. It doesn't get sidetracked by any type of theory or any type of conjecture
or issues with our mother.
Or is yeah, it, but even here, it, that's right, you know, and, or anything else, because those the issue, an issue with a mother or the way we were brought up, is something that that the result was that it has conditioned our thinking, and so it's the issue isn't then find out how awful your mother was or how wonderful she was, the issue is to realize that you're, there's something wrong with your thinking, and getting into the analysis of it. Is only a distraction, and look where that you know look where that can lead people to spending their lifetime now taking an identity that I'm so broken because of what this person did to me, whether it's a parent or an experience, and now you've created a view of yourself as a broken self, and that broken self can never be fixed because it's attached itself to a condition, and you're living the consequence of it rather than recognizing that it's my thinking that's the problem.
It's wrong view.
It's wrong view. So if I can change my view, including the view that has grown from a conditioned experience, which is what the whole point of this is, then I can awaken, then I can let go. And so the, in a sense, it is an authentic psychology, and it's saying, no matter what you think of yourself, there's nothing broken because it's just a view. Let go of the view. And, you know, I need to be a little bit careful here. There are people that have developed a true mental illness and psychoses that this may not help. And I'm only saying that because, you know, a lot of people, it's not, if you have some real mental illness, you might need a little bit more than the Dhamma. But at its very basic, it will heal all types of mental ills. But in a practical way, there's times when you might need some other help, too. Like, you might need a good therapist to get you focused in the right direction.
Or your brain chemistry is not.
Or your brain chemistry, yeah. So, again, just that qualification. But in general, it's simply wrong views. It has nothing to do with anything else except your own conditioned thinking. So thank you for bringing that up, too. It's important. David, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Very good. What I love about review is how you continually develop it, where you started, where you are now, to where you're going.
Yes.
And in reading this week, I bumped into it because I'd never heard it. But it was the water snake. Similar.
Yes.
And it, I just really enjoy how so much of the teachings are corrective. It kind of keeps pushing back to the right way to see things.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed that one. It's just a simple simile that where, and I think it was along with the raft.
Yeah.
That it's not giving up the raft on the other side, it's grasping it correctly.
Yeah.
Grasping right view. So it's just rich with corrective teachings all along. It's not just your initial view.
Yeah.
It's where you're going to end up. And that's where you get to the deepest level, the profound level that you talk about. So for the price that I'm paying, you know, what more can I want?
Yes, I agree. There's nothing lacking in the Dhamma, is there?
No.
And that the water snake sutta, that's the Alagadhapama Sutta. It's such an important one.
Easy for you to say.
Not so easy.
I mean, the Buddha called his monk to see him, to correct him.
Yes.
And he was mad.
Yeah. Yeah. I think in that sutta, because he used this phrase often, you foolish man. And that was, and some people would say, well, how can an awakened human being call that? He did that in the most compassionate way, to point out the foolishness to have these certain beliefs. Especially when coming from the point of view of a Buddha, an awakened human being, what more could you say? When you've heard the true Dhamma, because you know you spoke it yourself, and yet someone comes back to you with that. It's foolishness. That's all. But it's foolishness not in a judgmental or hurtful way, just to recognize. It's foolish to continue ignorant views, isn't it? Forget about the Dhamma. If you looked at something you did and realized that it was rooted in foolishness and you continue to do it, where does that come from? And who's the one that's continually being foolish? Yourself. That's all the Buddha's pointing out here. Again, very, very practical and direct teaching. Thank you, David. Keela, good to see you tonight.
Too. I'm very grateful for all your wisdom and the sanghas. We've been coming now for just just a few sessions, and it's just amazing how rich it is.
I agree.
While you're here, and it kind of helps keep that lens of awareness in everything you do throughout the day. You may not do it with right view or right intention, but you're noticing. It's an awareness.
Yeah.
And at the same time, it's so loving because you stop judging so harshly.
Yeah.
You just notice, and it's a much better way to live than living harshly and living in ignorance.
Yeah, I agree. Thank you for saying that. The Buddha teaches the middle way, the Eightfold Path, as the middle way between the extreme view that I have to be perfect even in this, that I can't ever, once I hear the Dhamma, I can't ever be engaged in wrong speech or wrong action or wrong livelihood. It's not that. We learn that we can, that the Dhamma applies to us wherever we are and whatever level of ignorance that we have in our life, and we take it from there. And the only way to do it is to not be harsh with ourselves. We must be gentle with ourselves, and we can do that because we understand that an awakened human being taught this for all human beings. In other words, we all are suffering from the same problem of ignorance.
It's so counterintuitive because we tend to want to push and grasp and hold, and this is a let go. And
yeah.
It's core. It sure sounds easy in practice. Not so much.
Not so much, but In the end, I think you'll all understand this now. Not that it's such a profound saying. In the end, the only path that remains is right view. And then everything is included in that. The entire understanding of Four Noble Truths is present in a mind that is rooted in right view. And it's a life of great meaning and purpose and freedom. And great gentleness towards ourselves and towards others. Thank you. Glad you're here. Please, I keep saying it. Please say hello to the lady. Ross, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Good, thank you. Well, I'm just still at the beginning. Just take it one step at a time, not get ahead of myself. So, Four Noble Truths and right view and right intentions, just trying to really focus on what that means and not think ahead.
Good.
Because I'm trying to build a good foundation, basically. So
that's where I'm at. Yeah, and again, thank you for saying that. It is so important to take your time, be gentle with yourself, and to build that foundation. I mean, this is what the Eightfold Path is. It's the foundation for awakening. And ultimately, it's that path that develops full awakening. So good. Glad you're here tonight. Lorna, good to see you. How are you?
Good. Nice to see a good-sized song tonight. I think I have a little difficulty holding right view. Well, as everybody else does, but how when you're thinking about the Dhamma and you're thinking about dropping your identity of who you are, I find that I don't have good judgment when I'm in a situation where I need to maybe stand up for myself or stand up for my views, stand up for not being walked over, not quite that bad, but when you try not to have views, it's hard to stand up to somebody else when for your views, when you try not to have views. it sometimes feels like I'm like glass, you know, that it will go through me and it won't stick. And I don't know if that's a good thing because it's gone right through me, something's walked right over me. So I think I have a conflict, or I haven't got the balance. ultimately I'm trying to hold right view.
Yeah. Wow, that's a question that would only come up if you weren't developing the Dhamma. It comes up because you're recognizing some of the seemingly paradoxical situations that we can run into when we're focusing on right view and all the rest of the right actions, even defending yourself. What are you defending? Why are you doing it? In every situation, as we develop the Eightfold Path, guides our interactions with others and with the world, rooted in that right intention, the intention to recognize and abandon craving and clinging, the intention to recognize and practice restraint at eye-making. And so as we start developing the Dhamma, that develops to very fine and subtle levels. In situations where we might have felt the need to stand up to the world, that starts diminishing. We find that we don't need to do that as often, but then situations will arise where we might feel that situationally it's important to defend myself. Someone is attacking me in a way that is questioning my very being. And so what do? We respond in a way that is framed by the Eightfold Path. There, most situations, it's appropriate to practice, it's always appropriate to practice right speech and right action. And so it might be that we simply move out of that situation. What I'm talking about now is if we're in a situation that we're being continually treated unfairly or in a hurtful way, right mindfulness says we move away from that situation completely and leave people in peace. But sometimes that's just not possible. And we also have to consider the other person in our response. Now I'm talking about, it means that we don't allow ourselves to be a doormat and be treated continually unfairly in a situation that we have some control over, because that's contributing to the other person's confusion and delusion and ongoing suffering, to allow that. And so in a very loving and peaceful way, we using the framework of the Eightfold Path, we point out why this is inappropriate. But, you know, we're getting into situations that are very subtle in how we apply the Dhamma in a wise and skillful way. And that consideration about the other person and their own suffering should always come into play. If I act like this is okay, am I tacitly approving how this person is acting? And that's never okay. So when we can have a true effect on what's going on around us, other people, then we should take right speech, right action, and move forward with that. When we know that it won't have any useful effect, we move on and let it go. But it takes some wise discernment. Just like David brought up about the foolish man, you know. Sometimes you have to say those things. You're being foolish. You're being hurtful. When you know that it's going to have some benefit. There are plenty of other stories in the suttas where people said things in front of the Buddha and he just let them go because he knew that it wouldn't have any useful effect. So you just keep your mouth shut. You know. But there's some fine levels of discernment that we are almost challenged to take responsibility for. As we develop awakening and we free ourselves of all self-referential views and we find our true place in the world, we realize that not in a clinging way, but we are, in essence, responsible for everything that's occurring within our own sphere of influence. In other words, that's why I say the most loving thing I can do for myself and for all of the sentient beings is to awaken. So I'm no longer contributing in any way, whether it's directly or tacitly, to other people's confusion and delusion and ongoing suffering.
I think what you just said just then is really, really important, because I was listening to Lorna and Ajahn Drup, but when you said you recognize that you're ultimately responsible for everything that occurs in your sphere of
influence.
So what I find is that the clearer, the more I let go of fixed views, something original emerges, and it might be counter. It'll surprise me because I've held like maybe being a nice person as something that that has restricted the truth being told when it's important. Mm-hmm. So being able to sit more with discomfort when it's important, because I'm, you know, like, it just takes discernment. So I think it's actions come. I went through a period of not really knowing what to say, and then all of a sudden it emerges as much more dynamic, free-flowing, situationally dependent ability to kind of see the whole context and respond, knowing roles and context and what's appropriate, and, you know, not always, but it's like, oh, I can take a much larger view and actually speak what seems appropriate.
Thank you. That's right. And what's most important, and it relates to what Maura just said, is that you're recognizing and developing understanding of true right action. But first, we have to work our way through our own conditioned thinking. And how does this work? How do I apply the Eightfold Path in the most practical way, moment by moment? And it always comes back to practicing restraint at eye making. But sometimes that's pretty confusing, isn't it? You know, it is. And it's only confusing because we still have some remnants of a conditioned mind. And recognizing it and working through it, maintaining that kashanti, that, you know, that perseverance is so important. Thank you. Okay. Liz, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you. Good to be here with all of you. I don't really have much to say. My practice is going well. I'm recognizing more of the things I cling to, and sometimes it's that thing. So when you hear the Four Noble Truths and the potential for the cessation of suffering, it sounds, I'm in for that. But then you subtly start to realize what the pieces of suffering are, mm-hmm. that you cling to as part of who you are. Mm-hmm. And some of that can present itself in situations where maybe someone is speaking to you in a way that isn't respectful or whatever. You know, we go back to those old places pretty readily. So anyway, I'm just starting to look at that kind of concept of what is it that I cling to that could be, you know, the first and primary and most helpful thing that I can let go of.
Wow.
So that's what I've been playing around with.
That's pretty good stuff to play around with. Really getting to the heart of the matter. And it does come down to that. What am I holding on to? You know, what self-referential views am I clinging to that I won't let go of?
That this is a solid thing, period. This is all there is. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't even have to be some role. Like, I think the suffering comes up just in a general sense of dissatisfaction. And it becomes clearer and clearer how that... It's not like, oh, I'm a bad person, I'm a good person, I'm this. Just this thing needs to be satisfied.
Mm-hmm. Does right intention lead to right judgment?
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
That's just so we're at least making right decisions because we have the right intention.
Yes, that's why, and I really didn't get too deep into it tonight, but right intention is just that. It's holding that intention in a general way to live gently in the world and to awaken in every situation. And in following right view and the integration of the Eightfold Path, it follows from that. Bonnie, good to see you.
Scott. What Scott was saying is right judgment. For me, it's not necessarily right judgment, but it is that sort of clarity that Maura was talking about. So it's not as angular to me as judgment, but it's that there's a clarity in the moment.
Yeah.
That you find out what it is that you need to do as someone who's on this path. And it adds to the skillfulness of the Dhamma and how you use that as you move through life.
Yes, and that you use the word need, and that's right. That then it becomes an individual's responsibility to act appropriately, skillfully, within the framework of the Eightfold Path. Another word for judgment or right judgment would be discernment or wisdom. You have now gained the ability to see things as they really are, which is simply another word for awakening or full human maturity. You see things as they really are, so you can respond in an appropriate and skillful way. That's an awakened human being. And that leaves one free of any type of agitated mind state. And that doesn't mean that what's going on around you might be unpleasant. But because you don't need it to be any different than it is, because you're seeing things clearly, your mind stays calm and at peace. The Buddha was in the middle of every major conflict that happened in northern India at the time. The leaders were always asking Siddhartha, what do I do? What do I do? He was there all the time. And his response always was not to be a doormat, not to bury your head in the sand. This is how you act. And even to rulers that were thinking of or knowing that war was coming with the next kingdom or whatever was always going on. All these little kingdoms in northern India were always in conflict with each other. The Buddha advised him. He didn't say you can never fight or you can never defend yourself. The Buddha was not a pacifist in any way, by the way, and I won't get into that tonight. He was a realist. He knew that conflict exists in the world. This is how you act. And even when he was addressing, and this relates to what you were talking about, Lorna, but in a larger scale, even when he was addressing a king or some type of ruler and knew that that king or ruler was going into battle and was going to be killing people, he knew that that was inevitable. But then he taught how to act once you've won. He taught to treat your those that are what's the conquest. Treat them fairly. Yeah. Treat them within the framework of the Eightfold Path. Even so far as saying that when you've conquered this other kingdom, then give them food, give them shelter, give them medicine. Take care of them because now that's your responsibility. Mm-hmm. Not to treat them as slaves, and this even relates back to King Ashoka 300 years after the Buddha's death. He taught inevitable reality in every situation. He never taught in a way that was unrealistic or could not be developed. And the end result of what he taught was always framed by the Dhamma. In any conflict.
Dynamic, based on a framework.
And when you understand this, it does be, who was talking about Ram? It becomes almost automatic. Not almost, it's automatic how you think and how you act. Because there's no conflict left in your own mind, you don't teach any type of conflict. You're able to engage in right judgment all the time.
Yeah, the lack of conflict, internal conflict, is really the greatest part. You're not going back on yourself. What am I going to do? No, it isn't.
It's never, that's a calm and peaceful mind. That's an awakened mind. And because you have no longer, you have abandoned all internal conflict, you can't present it to the world. You can't teach it in any way. You can't encourage it in any way. You know the direct path to ending conflict because you've ended it within yourself. What a class. Bonnie.
Hello.
Thank you,
Bonnie. So for me, the framework beginning with the view is nothing happens without it. And that, so what Lorna's talking about, in my livelihood, part of what I've been trying to do, instead of calling it wisdom, it's non-judgmental nature, whether it's looking at whatever I'm looking at. And so for many years, being in situations where the expectation is I'm going to react in a non-judgmental way, and watching other people who don't have that responsibility to act, they act and they say whatever they need to say, and I've been in the past thought, what might that lecturist really say what it is without feeling what? So I think the Eightfold Path gives me this framework. So if I, because I can't do anything unless I see it, and the rolling around and rolling around deepens every time. It's like the layers of an onion, so it can get deeper and deeper, but it also, in the being compassionate, in the being aware of what arises and then what falls away. So as opposed to something arises and I conditionally react to it, which is punching, you know, as opposed to becoming aware of it, nothing has to be fixed. Just being able, and I think then the meditation gives you the space in order to be able to have that empty space to contain it, so that I can see what it is, and then I can think about what's the, not that I do this, I mean, it's a practice, right? It's the wisdom practice, what I call a practice, but so that I can speak to something in a diplomatic way, in a non-judgmental way, but to not speak the truth, and to find that way, you know, so that you can say, that was sort of harsh, or in a way that, so I can get myself out of the arrow's way, right? And but because it feels like, and I think, you know, one of the things that I take away too is that you often think that without a self I don't have feelings, but I do. But it's in a way, you know, also it's so cyclical in terms of how I can hold it and address it. And acknowledging it sometimes, just not, oh, there's that thing, instead of trying to react unconsciously in a way that maybe that I say wrong speech, or I, even if it's unintentional. So it's so I think I get more clarity too as I've been okay with the mindfulness off the cushion, and my on the cushion time has really increased, and I think that's really made a big difference for me. But
yeah. Thank you, Bonnie. When we develop the Dhamma, we cease taking anything personally. So even in a one-on-one situation that might have in the past felt very agitating, because we're not defending a self, we're not taking it personally, people can say or do anything they want. If I don't take it personally, it doesn't disturb me. I don't have to defend myself. And so the Buddha didn't teach that there's, in order to achieve that, we have to develop some idea that there's no such thing as a self. That's not what he taught. He simply taught that what is a self, what constitutes a self, is in a constant state of becoming. The dependent origination teaches that. And so then the question is, what am I going to become? In this moment of apparent conflict, am I going to become more agitated? No, I want to maintain a calm and peaceful mind, so I'm going to recognize and cease taking this personal, because it's not meant that way. No matter what is coming at me, no matter what somebody might be saying to me, it's from their point of view. My view can only connect with that view if it's a wrong view, then, if I take it personally. If I recognize that, I can leave the situation and that other person at peace. It might mean that I no longer interact with that person because they're hurtful. That's okay. You know, nothing that says that I should open myself up to abuse. But I cease taking any of this personal. Doesn't matter.
Because doesn't that also mean what comes up internally, like our conditioned responses, like not taking that personal? Because
that's the whole thing. That's the point.
So whatever is arising, right, Bonnie, inside of, you know, my reactive nature that's just arising that hasn't given risen to action and speech, it's like, you know, this is old. It doesn't even have to be analyzed. It's just watching the arising and the passing of feelings and giving them space and then investigating.
As we get into the later
Yeah.
To see it as close to its inception as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, and it's not personal. And that's where I think when you said, you know, leaving the space, like, it's happening now, but it's not like there's something wrong, like, not attached to that this is me that has this reaction. This is where it has this. Yeah.
Thank you. As we get into the later parts of the course, we get into week 7, 8, 9, we get into dependent origination and then the three marks of existence. The three marks of existence and understanding that explains how conflict arises, how to recognize it, and how to abandon it. And now we're, if you understand how the course is developed, now we're developing the framework to recognize what occurs within the impermanent nature and as a result of wrong views of self. We simply let them go. There's nothing that can be harmed. It doesn't mean the fact that nothing can be harmed doesn't mean that there's nothing there. It simply means we stop taking it personally. Another great misunderstanding Mahayana Buddhism used to justify that understanding without really thinking about it. I'll say it again. Just because there's nothing to take personally doesn't mean that there's nothing occurring. There's nothing here. The Buddha never taught that. The Buddha simply taught that whatever what constitutes a self is in a constant state of becoming, and that leads to the question of what am I going to become in this instant, right
moment,
now? What am I going to hold in mind? Pardon
moment
me?
By moment, right?
moment by moment. And that's an awakened, fully mature mind, a mind that is able to maintain its mindfulness without distraction, without conflict, no matter what's occurring, moment by moment. Another way of describing that is we're able to stay fully present with our life as it unfolds without the need for it to be any different. And how can we do that? Because there's no conflict in our mind. There's no conflict in our mind because we don't need what's occurring to be any different than it is. Great class. any questions? See you, Mary Beth. Any questions before we close? And we'll, you know, hopefully it's not a good. We've gotten on a little bit. It's a little after 9 o'clock. So let's finish with metta like we always do. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mind. Close your minds. Close your mouth. And now again is the time to meditate. So take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace. Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.